Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 47, which is a prime number. And since I was a math major, I really enjoy prime numbers. Just a side note, I am recording this podcast from my backyard in Burbank, California. Why is that important? Well, it's pretty late and I am going to record this just a few hours before I have to leave to get on a flight to Cancun, Mexico, which is where I'm going to be at the 3D Symposium Conference. I'm very excited to be there, but I'm also not too excited about the fact that I haven't had any sleep. And hopefully while I'm there, I'm going to record a podcast there. So look forward to that podcast from Cancun. The other reason that it's interesting that I'm in my backyard is that the fact that yesterday I saw a pack of six coyotes leaving my neighbor's backyard. There is literally coyotes everywhere here in Burbank. So I'm actually a little bit in danger. Hopefully I'll be okay. So this podcast features Oleg Alexander, who has been a very big contributor to the Wiki Human Project. He has been working until recently at the Institute of Creative Technology with a bunch of other people from the Digital Human League, which is part of University of Southern California. And he's been a very big contributor to what we've been doing there. So if you are downloading or have downloaded the Digital Emily 2.1 project, Oleg was a big contributor to what made that project so special and is also a big contributor to the next phase of the project, which will be coming out at some point very soon. The other person that is a guest on this project is Stephen Parker. And Stephen Parker works at Chaos Group, and I have worked with Stephen over at Digital Domain and knows a great deal about digital humans. And I was really happy that he jumped into this podcast and made it happen as well. So why is this podcast happening? This is happening specifically as a response to episode number 46 with Norman Seif. Norman, if you listen to that episode, and if you haven't listened to that episode, go back and listen to it. But Norman had specific ideas about what was going on and the balance between art and science of digital humans. And Oleg had opinions that are similar and different from that. And I decided that we needed to have a podcast specifically dealing with the balance of art and science and how it deals with digital humans. I think this episode is extremely interesting. It gets very technical and also very much ethereal in terms of what that balance is and why it exists. I think it appeals to a broad audience, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I do. All right, guys, thanks a lot.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
So you inspired me basically with the when we had our lunch and you were talking about specifically your ideas behind the relationship between art and science, right? And how there's a relationship there. And I had just done this podcast with Norman when I was at THU, mm-hmm. Which was very much a similar subject matter. And it's related to something that all of us are involved with, which is the Digital Human Project, right?
Yeah.
And even Steven's involved with it, although let's call him a silent partner. Yeah, but Stephen had actually been doing a lot. I've learned a lot about digital humans and shading and stuff like that from Stephen when we were working on things at DD, mm-hmm. and he was, he was the one who worked on Tupac and all that stuff.
Oh, very good.
So,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, so what I think is interesting is that you obviously had some. You believed much more in that art has a that science has a much bigger role to play in art, and art is not necessarily as interesting. There was something about it that you felt that art can be 100% scientific in some way. There was something you said that was very interesting to me. What was it specifically about your relationship between art and science?
I'm not sure what I said. What is it that I said? I don't remember.
You said that you used to believe that there are some things that cannot be scientific.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. No, that's true. Yeah, I said that I used to believe that at a certain point, science has a limit. And, you know, then, okay, the artist takes over and, you know, it's like, I'll take it from here. I'm the artist. Mm-hmm. I used to believe that. I don't believe that so much anymore.
Right.
I think that, you know, science has a way of catching up. And it may take a very long time for science to catch up to something that an artist can do very quickly, but eventually it'll catch up. And then the artist will be, you know, doing something else, basically, because he doesn't have to do that step anymore. That step has been automated.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. So, and I know what you mean by that. And there's a lot to be said about art and science as a relationship.
Yeah.
But let's go back a little step before that. You have an artist background as well as a science background, correct? Which allowed you to sort of deal with those two different philosophies.
Yeah.
Would you call them opposing philosophies?
No, no. I think, you know, the creative process would be the same. In any field, I think, or similar in any field. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the process of solving problems is similar across fields.
It's creative.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you feel that problem solving is a creative problem, Stephen?
You mean, is it challenging creatively?
Yeah.
Or can you be creative in problem solving? Sure. I mean, it's the nature of the problem, whether it's a logical problem or a creative problem, or, you know, a problem is a problem.
Mm.
You solve it, you know, you may use a little bit of both, I think, regardless of the, you know, of the problem type.
Okay. Well, okay, then what's the difference between creative and art?
I mean, maybe we should reframe it.
Okay.
in that, you know, are we talking about this in terms of the context of digital humans?
We are, and we're going to get there. We're going to totally get
right,
there.
Okay, so, because, yeah. Because I think, I mean, because, you know, you could end up vilifying Oleg, because we're talking very generically.
I'm not vilifying Oleg.
No, I mean, but I'm like, we're coming out of the gate with, like, because, you know, we're not talking about abstract art, you know, we're not talking about,
nope.
Yeah, so
nope.
So when he says, when we're talking about these,
yes,
things, we're
exactly
talking about.
And I want to define, I want to make some definitions before we do this.
All right,
and let's just real. I don't want to spend too much time, but I want people to have an idea of your background, to understand where you're coming from. So, where is your artist background and where's your science background, and how did those things sort of come together?
Yeah, let's see. So, I started doing art when I was about 14,
mm-hmm,
and I took some classes at this local art academy in Florida, some private classes. And my teacher was a classically trained illustrator.
Illustrator?
Yeah.
Okay.
And basically, you know, the first thing they had me do is start copying anatomy books.
Okay.
Right. That was one of my first lessons. So I really got into figure drawing. And I continued it through high school, through the end of high school, drawing and painting, mostly figure drawing.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I switched my focus to film, went to film school, and then by accident, I walked into a Maya class, and I really loved it. And
accidentally walked into it.
Accidentally walked, like literally accidentally
it's like,
walked.
Oops, this is the wrong class.
it was Yeah, it was a lot like that.
And that's awesome.
Yeah, it was it's by luck.
When was this? About when was that?
This was about 2003. Actually, 2002 when I accidentally walked into this class.
Okay.
And then I decided,
this was in film school?
Yeah. And yeah.
Where did you go to film
this
school?
This was at the end of film school.
Okay.
Well, the story goes that I needed a 4-credit course to graduate, and I looked at the curriculum, and all the courses were 3-credit courses, except for this one course, this AP course that was 4 credits, and it was called like Advanced Digital Video or something like that. It had no other description. So I just took it thinking it was editing or something like that. And it turned out to be Maya.
Mm.
When I walked in, I was like, wow, this is great. This okay. is really cool. So,
but you had no idea what it was.
I had no idea. No, and
what school was this?
This was Florida Atlantic University.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So then later, a year later, I came back and got my master's in computer animation.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what kept happening is during that time, you know, we had to make every 6 months we had to make like a 30-second piece, which we created all by ourselves, like a 3D animated short.
Sure.
You know, from start to finish. And for some weird reason, I spent 90% of my time on rigging.
Uh-huh. Well, was it because it was the hardest thing to do? Or is it because you really enjoyed rigging?
I think it was because I really cared about the, you know,
the anatomy
and
so it goes back
and,
to your roots
and the deformation being, you know, looking correct and, you know, the muscles being correct.
Yeah. I can see that.
You see what I mean? Like I like to say that I didn't find rigging found me, you know.
Right.
And yeah, so after that, obviously, I learned scripting and I got into all that. And mm-hmm. yeah, so it's kind of the best of both worlds.
Right.
Yeah.
But then you sort of started going into more technology stuff, right?
Yeah, even more mathy stuff. But it's still an extension of tool building and automation.
Well, rigging guys are tend to be very technical.
Yeah.
They kind of have to be.
Yeah.
So,
but I mean, there's an art to it as well.
And, of course.
And I would say there's two kinds of art, in rigging. One, which is kind of just the skill, you know, the technical skill that you have, you know, just the kind of having an eye for it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the modeling and such. There's another skill, which is the creation of the rig, the creation of the rig structure, kind of the schema of it,
mm-hmm.
right? Is something that doesn't necessarily have a right answer. You know, it's your interpretation mm-hmm. of how something moves. It's basically the rigger's model of how something moves.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're trying to also communicate that model to the animator
right.
as well. So those are the kind of the two arts of rigging, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, for those who may not necessarily, because we have a fairly broad audience on the podcast, those who don't necessarily understand what a rigger does, a rigger is basically the digital puppeteer.
Yeah, yeah.
The one that makes the puppets,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
The one that actually makes the functionality of puppets and how things move and what they look like when they change shape, et cetera, et cetera.
It's like a virtual mechanical engineer.
Like a virtual mechanical engineer. Exactly. I like it. But then the animator takes those tools and uses them to create the performance.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So they're two different things, but they work very well hand in hand. It's like the race car driver and the mechanic in a lot of
yeah,
ways.
Yeah,
exactly. So it's really kind of interesting and a good rig goes a long way, right?
Yes.
There's a lot of things that we'll get into as an example, but we can or go back to it at some point. It's a lot of things that you can do in a rig that can automate things realistically in order to give them more realism, right? So you can do things like automate
the jiggle of something that happens as opposed to process or all those types of things. And that minimizes what the rigging people can do.
You mean the animators?
The animators can do.
Need to do. Well, you know, I have I don't know a couple of views on that. When I first started rigging faces at Image Metrics, I used to rig the sticky lips as part of the logic of the rig.
Exactly.
And you know, so basically the logic was that whenever the mouth opens, or basically whenever the jaw opens, then the sticky lips would peel apart.
Right.
And that was a bad idea, you know? Well, so basically I stopped doing that and instead I just created a simple sticky lips control that the animator can use whenever they want. So I left it up to the animator, for the most part to do those kinds of things. The only thing that I tend to automate in faces is the soft eyes. You know, it's like, this is the effect of when you're looking around, your eyelids are tugging along because the corneal bulge is pushing on your eyelids.
Right.
So that's the only thing that I automate, as well as the jaw open corrective is another thing I automate. But pretty much everything else I leave as a control for the animator.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Okay. So... that's good because we got an idea. You studied art. You started with anatomy.
Yeah.
You went into film. So I'm assuming you were interested in storytelling and directing and things like that.
Yeah.
And then you got involved in technology and you figured out through your Maya class that you had a passion for rigging and understanding that. Going back to your roots of anatomy and now leaving you to the point where you're doing a lot of rigging. And the place that I've met you was over at ICT, right? And so at ICT, and you and I have actually worked together quite a bit on Digital Emily, and it was a lot of fun to do that. And we learned a lot in that process.
We did, actually,
And it was really, really cool. So that establishes that thing. Now, the thing that was important to us is that part of the thing that's going on over at ICT, what I enjoyed as well, is part of the motivation to doing this Digital Emily project is to scientifically remove as many variables as possible. So going back to your thing, I'm actually trying to automate a bunch of things as opposed to your rigs where you're trying to give those controls back to some of the animators. But we're trying to automate as much of the information to remove as many variables as possible so that we know part of the issues with digital humans is that there's too much left to interpretation and there's too many things that people don't understand.
Exactly.
And therefore, when something's wrong, no one knows where it went wrong. Does that kind of make sense? Yeah. Kind of. That we all agree on most of that.
There's usually a lot of finger pointing.
There is a lot of finger pointing. And there's a lot. Yeah,
because there's so many departments and disciplines involved. Mm-hmm. But when you're looking at it, I mean, you just pick little things out that you think might be the cause, and you know, it usually doesn't turn out to be that, you know, that one little thing. It's usually the summation of all those little things, but still doesn't stop all the finger pointing for the
movie. There's a lot
the modeler gets upset with the texture artist. The texture artist is,
and then the animator blames it on the lighting, and the lighting blames it on the animation, and it's always a big brouhaha. And I'm tired of it partly, and I was like, there's got to be a better way, right? So that was one of the initial motivations of the WikiHuman project, is like, we have the, you know, in terms of what the texture needs to look like, as an example of what you just said, we have that texture information from an ICT scan. We should not be questioning that, right?
Well,
as long as we put it together correctly, it should be working.
Well, sort of.
Sort of? Yeah, okay. Sort of. Tell me the sort of reason.
So the sort of is that, the maps that ICT delivers are kind of more geared for real-time renders than offline renders.
Yes and no, but it's still a measured data, right?
Yes, but it's not measured. Let me put it this way. It's not delivered in the same format as your shading model.
Right.
Okay. So that's kind of a
that's
kind of a problem.
Yes, but our shading model is not necessarily defined correctly either.
Well, whatever shading model you have, it's ICT data isn't that.
Right.
So what I mean by that, just as an example, what I mean by that is, for example, we have these very nice diffuse maps with no specular because we cross-polarized the specular. And you would think that's great, except that in an offline render, the ambient occlusion is something that gets computed, but in the map, the ambient occlusion is already baked in.
Yes, but we unbaked the ambient occlusion as well.
And that's part of what I'm saying. So that's like an additional step you have to take.
Right.
There's more to it than that. For example, the roughness parameter, or the glossiness parameter.
Yes.
In V-Ray, it's called glossiness.
Right.
Right. So we don't have that.
We don't have that, no.
No. So, and that's another thing that we can compute, potentially, from a one light at a time data set.
Mm-hmm.
But so far, we haven't done it.
But what we do is we have extraordinarily good reference, right?
Yes, yes.
So by using extraordinarily good reference, it's much easier to match the reference in terms of like, all right, well, I'm going to eyeball that, but you're only using specific data. So you're only changing one variable until it matches the reference.
Yeah.
And then if it matches the reference and you're using the exact kind of lighting that was used and the exact same everything else, it'll be, that's the roughness.
And
I believe that's scientific enough.
It needs to be done per pixel.
It needs to vary across
the surface. It needs to be done per pixel. So, at some point, there's going to be some fudge factor,
Well, okay, but
if you do it artistically, and I'm not saying that you can't. I'm not saying that you can't, give it to a really good texture artist and say, look, just make it look like that. And mm-hmm. and even if you have, perfectly calibrated reference,
mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that a texture artist won't be able to do it. In fact, they'll probably do a great job. But that's some artistry there. That's a little bit open to fudge,
Okay.
Yeah.
But part of it, the idea was behind the micro displacement information is that it reduces the need for variation because of the micro displacement.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Because it does vary across the surface.
Right.
To some extent. I mean.
Well, no.
It's like patches. The way we do it is patches that are interpolated.
Right.
I wouldn't call it a per pixel solve.
No, yeah. I understand. But it's pretty close, and it does make a big difference.
Yes.
And we actually did a blog post on WikiHuman where Koki was basically describing, this is what we're doing. We're down to 10 microns, which is pretty darn small.
Yeah.
But if we really want to get accurate, we got to get down to a couple of nanometers where it's the wavelength size, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
If we're down to a wavelength, then we know we can use a perfect mirror, right? But of course, we'd have to.
Yeah. Maybe not a perfect mirror, but something close to it. And that could be constant, and then the roughness could come from the microgeometry.
Right.
That's correct.
Okay. Yeah. But all right, so let's talk about some of the other things. That was, sort of got the idea of where we're going and the philosophy behind things. But one of the things we talked about with Norman, or I talked about with Norman, was the idea mm-hmm. that. About the Uncanny Valley, I figured because of his particular skill set as an artist, he may have an interesting opinion or point of view on the Uncanny Valley and what that is. So first I had to explain that to him.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to teach him what that was. And hopefully I did a good job. I felt like I was rambling a little bit in the beginning. But
no, I think it was a good explanation.
Okay. but anyway, he seemed to understand it. And I gave him some graphs so he could figure it out.
Yeah.
What was interesting also was his idea that, there's only so much you can do scientifically, and that the thing that's missing, that you seem to be missing in the Uncanny Valley, is consciousness, right?
Mm-hmm.
So consciousness is this thing that you haven't quite, you can't measure right now, and that he feels that is something that is very much part of an artist's vocabulary that is easier to see as an artist. Now,
okay.
Let's there's something about the way that you described what we were doing in terms of the difference between the art and science of things, right? And you mentioned, you put an email out to me about this specific thing. Mm-hmm. One of them was the creative process.
Yeah.
And this is something we're struggling with in terms of the WikiHuman, and it's like you just said, there's a lot of finger pointing, right? The creative process involves trial and error.
Yes.
There's a lot of, did that work? Nope. Try it again.
Yeah.
Did that work? Try it again.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
I mean, science does that too, obviously.
Sure. Sure. That's what I mean, that, you know, the creative process in general is similar across fields, you know.
Right.
As long as it involves trial and error, then you are
performing the scientific method.
You are, well, sort of, except faster, you know. So,
do you think that, you know, from the artistic point of view, as opposed to the science point of view, it's more of an arbitrary decision? It's a gut feeling, right?
Specifically,
it's like, I think this needs more red, so I'm just going to add
subjective,
more
subjective, though, right?
This is subjective, right?
Well, I'm not sure. In the context of photorealism, you know, I think what Norman is saying is that, yeah, you still need the actor to drive the performance.
Sure.
Right? You certainly can't, at least not at this point in time, and, you know, I've seen some work in this field, so. so far I'm not impressed. Basically, you know, when you try to automate the appearance of emotion, it looks bad.
Right.
Okay. When you have an actor driving a rig, it looks a lot better. It really translates. And, you know, if the rig and animation are good, you really capture the soul of the actor.
Okay.
So in the sense of, I think maybe what Norman's trying to say is that you need still a human being to drive the performance, because, you know, we still haven't come to a point where we can automate a performance. In terms of photorealism, however, I think, you know, I'm not sure what consciousness has to do with trying to reproduce a photograph.
It's not about that.
Because once the photograph has been taken, then it's just kind of either a manual or tool-aided process of trying to reproduce it.
Well, let's start with the idea of the uncanny valley. So, mm-hmm. What puts it in the uncanny valley? And the idea is,
yeah,
I don't know until it's right. Right? It's, and so that's the problem, is how do we define it? And so the person that can define it as being good is the person that can take it from the I don't know to it's good. It's not his argument. It's the person's going to go, this looks like in the uncanny valley. This is now out of the uncanny valley. The person who's going to drive that is going to be much more likely someone who's going to be able to convey emotion. And that's not necessarily going to be through a scientific method.
Like I said, you know, if you're working from a photograph, I don't think it makes any difference how you approach it. As long as you get there, it doesn't matter how you get there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, whatever your medium is, I mean, you could be a painter and try and reproduce a photograph perfectly,
right?
And that's just what that shows, you know, from the point of view of photorealism, the fact that you can reproduce a photograph perfectly just shows that you're highly skilled. Right. So it doesn't, you know, so there's that part of it where it's just a skill part of reproducing it.
Yes.
Right. However you did it, maybe, you know, maybe you use some science, whatever, or maybe you just, you know, painted every pixel or something like that. But what I'm trying to say is that the process of taking the photograph itself is the artistic process. I think there's more art in taking the photograph.
Yes.
There's the lighting and the subject matter and all those things.
Absolutely.
Right? So from the moment you take the photograph, then at that point you just become some kind of a monkey trying to reproduce it. But it's the subject matter and the lighting the choices that you make in taking that photograph that's the art part. That's the subjective part.
Now, don't you think when someone painted, you know, when they painted Mona Lisa and everyone commented about her smile and understanding, et cetera, that's not a photograph he took.
Exactly. Right. No, exactly.
She's out of the uncanny valley in a sense, if we're going to talk about some art history there. This is long before that idea. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. You know, art history. So, my favorite painter is Sargent.
Yeah.
And I mean, to me, he's just a god, really. What he was doing wasn't photorealism, but he had a kind of style. He was kind of a virtuoso of making a paint stroke and really making it stick.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? Like, he wouldn't futz around with the paint stroke. He would just make the damn paint stroke, and that would be it.
Right.
So, I mean, that's skill, but. That's what I mean by skill,
mm-hmm.
But there's also, you know, the composition and the choice of attire and the lighting and the colors,
sure.
And the palette, and kind of, you know, trying. I'm sure he tried to flatter his subjects as well in the paintings.
Yeah, but there's okay. What's that document, that Netflix documentary, Vermeer, the guy?
Tim's Vermeer, right. That's
Tim Jensen.
Yeah.
Right. So that's the same thing I'm talking about there.
That's exactly what I'm doing. And I want to describe it real quick, because if those of you guys haven't seen it, I believe it's on Netflix.
Yeah.
And it's called Tim's Vermeer, and the guy is Tim, I forgot his last name.
Jensen,
thank you.
The guy who wrote Lightwave,
very, you know, he's... pretty famous CG guy.
He formed New Tech.
Right. Yeah. But he's like the main. He's like the main Lightwave guy. Really smart guy. And they made a documentary that of his obsession with Vermeer, the painter Vermeer.
Yeah.
Done by Penn Jillette, who's a friend of his.
Mm-hmm.
Penn Jillette from Penn and Teller. Basically, he had this theory that Vermeer used photographic methods to paint his paintings.
Yeah.
And he wanted to prove that was the case.
Yeah.
So he basically created what he thought was possible at that time, which was a pinhole camera system to project an image, whatever was happening, onto a canvas and painted that canvas by hand.
Yeah.
And he took him almost a year to paint it or something like
Yeah.
But he recreated... He basically tried to scientifically recreate a Vermeer using the same exact scientific method that he had done.
Yeah.
Basically meaning, as you pointed out, that he basically created a camera. He believes he created a camera and he painted from that camera.
Yeah.
And that's why his paintings look so real.
Yeah.
They even have depth of field and other aspects in it and some...
Chromatic aberration,
right.
Yeah.
So all of those aspects were part of that process.
But he reverse engineered a painting, and he suspected that optics were involved.
Yeah. I mean,
chromatic aberration being a dead giveaway.
Yeah, right.
Which was, it's interesting because I think one of the things that they discussed in that, was that a big... You know, these guys had their bag, you know, their bag of tricks, and one of the most fundamental ones was the paint itself. right? Like they
they made their own
they
pants.
They had to be part chemists, and a lot of them had secrets and in terms of getting which, you know, rich, vibrant colors or whatever. But you know, and they didn't share those.
No, and just like today with our
and you know, if you know, Durer and the grid for recreating perspective. I mean, those were tools as well, and you know,
yeah,
that was just another step forward in, you know, in that they were using some kind of optical, you know, method or whatever. I mean, it was really interesting, but at the same time, it was, I mean, it was photorealish, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't hype, it wasn't hyperreal. And it was photorealish, but there was definitely, you know, a style to it as well. It wasn't like he used it, but there was obviously artistic license in
well, he still composed the image, et cetera, just like you were saying, right? You
yes,
know, the thing is, there's something right about you know. In fact, Norman himself can barely operate a camera. He says that about himself, which is kind of the irony of it. But to him, his art
is motivating them.
Is motivating the situation and capturing the moment.
Yeah.
Being the ability to click that button at the exact right moment to get that exact right thing that he wants. And he obviously takes hundreds and hundreds of photographs, but he is getting that idea, and his art is almost philosophy, right? His art is, or psychology.
Mm-hmm. Right? Psychology, yeah.
So, and that's a really interesting thing, but what fascinated me specifically about him is that his what he's doing is to bring life, let's just say, or interest, or when you see a Norman C. photograph, you're like, oh, you know, you're like that person, you feel that person, you get empathy, you feel like you sense that you were there at a moment, even though it's just a series of pixels on my computer screen or whatever it is. You sense the moment, you understand, you bond with this person, something that is severely lacking from people that recognize the Uncanny Valley, right? One of the things he says in the beginning of the podcast is distance causes severe pain. Mm-hmm. Like when you feel distance from someone, you feel pain. And so therefore the Uncanny Valley, he feels, the way you're describing it to me, it sounds like it's a painful experience, right? Mm-hmm. You're like, you know, that's a distant person. That's a person with no emotions or whatever it is. And what is the emotion? So trying to understand what that is, In a sense, I would love to be able to figure out if we can measure that. Do you feel that we can measure that? Do you think that we're going to come to a point where we can measure that, what brings something out of the Uncanny Valley, where I can go, scientifically speaking, you need this much more, this much more, this much more, and therefore that person that photograph will not feel like the Uncanny Valley?
It depends. Are you trying to match to, you know, objectively match to a photograph? Because you can do a difference image and it'll tell you exactly what the error is.
It's true.
You know what I mean?
It's true, but not necessarily. Yeah, because, go ahead.
Yeah. So, or are you trying to not work from a photograph?
Well, we are working from a photograph. We're working from reference, right? That's how we know that our data is measurable, right?
Right.
But I want to be able to take Mike, right? And I would like to be able to get a performance out of him and make it work. Now, we can go pixel for pixel and match his performance to what we recorded on video, right?
Yes.
And know that it's exactly right. And technically that should be correct. Yes, that's something we can do. Or we can have him do a performance that's not recorded and know scientifically what needs to happen on that, right?
Are you trying to say that you want to automate a performance? You know, maybe. Some of their moves like Mike.
Well, there's a lot of people who create, a lot of people who recreate characters, right? And do characters out there without without reference, right? They fictionalize, they make people, right?
Okay.
And they're not necessarily people. Luke has been working on this woman for a long time. Luke Begins.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
And that's a fictional person, so it's a complete figment of his imagination. It's really tough. There's no reference of that. He's basically And there is a challenge there because I think some people could say there's something weird about her and she's a little bit in the uncanny valley. She's very attractive, et cetera, and it looks very interesting, but there's something a little bit weird about her. And that's a little bit challenging for him to figure out because he doesn't have anything to base it on.
Right.
But do you think that there's going to be something we can say, the issue is this? Like, do you think based on, if you're going to create a completely synthetic person with no reference, would you be able to get that person scientifically out of the uncanny valley?
Probably. I mean, you could do a statistical model of a whole bunch of people and see how well it matches, see how well it fits the fictional person.
Okay.
So scientifically, I'm sure it's measurable.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you think you could create something that someone could bond with and create and it's like, hey.
I mean, in terms of animation, I think we're way off on that.
Okay, yeah.
And, you know, the animation side is.
I know. This is something we're just starting to tackle.
Yeah,
right now.
I mean, that's far off. But I think in terms of a still image, it's something you can measure. You know, you can come up with a PCA model of a whole slew of people and then match. Match the fictional person, see what happens, you know, see if that matches reality or statistical reality, you know.
That's interesting.
So, yeah, it's possible.
Okay. All right. So that the reason I brought that up is I want to talk about the measurability of things, right? So what's measurable?
Right.
And I think science is... likes to measure things.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? It likes to define what, you know, oh, this is this and this and therefore, et cetera, et cetera. And one other thing that science loves to do is reduce variables, right? So that we know this to be a truth, so therefore there's no longer a variable in that idea, right? Variable reduction.
Yeah, I mean, is that like testing one variable at a time? Is that what you mean? Like the scientific method?
Yes. But I mean also saying, you know, yes, in a sense.
Okay.
That is like, okay, I know this is no longer.
Or do you mean deriving the model?
Deriving the model.
Yes. Yeah. Right. So yeah, that's slightly different.
Yes.
But yeah, deriving the model. I mean, it's not about eliminating variables. It's more like just coming up with an elegant model. Which may or may not be what's really going on, as long as it's practical.
Okay.
Right. You know? So it may include a lot of assumptions
or
fixed constraints or something.
Okay.
Exactly. I mean, it's let's just go back to the example of the roughness parameter or glossiness, as it's called in V-Ray.
Yep.
You know, what is that, really? I mean, it's the microfacet model, but... What are these microfacets? Well, we just learn with Koki that you know, that's when you zoom in.
Yeah.
So when you zoom in that close and when you actually have that as geometry, all of a sudden
your model changes.
All of a sudden, you know, glossiness is not as important. That can remain constant.
Mm-hmm.
So the model has changed, right? So
not
you know,
the, not well. Actually, both.
Well,
the geometric model and the mathematical model.
Yeah, exactly. So,
exactly.
Yeah. So explain that a little bit, Stephen. What do you mean by that? Yeah. I know what you mean, but I want the audience to know.
Well, the problem, the solution exists in two places, right? Like you take the geometric model to a certain extent, and then you rely on the shading to layer in on top of that to get you some semblance of information that
the model
wasn't reproducible in
the model,
right? So I think we're gonna say model a bunch, but anyway, right. We'll just say the shading is the mathematical model, and the you know, the geometric model is
right
because you only have so many polygons sculpt, you put into a model, right?
But when the geometric model, you know, advances, and then the burden of you know, making up for that loss of detail in the shading goes away. So then you have to change
your mathematical model.
Or simplify your shading model, right?
Which was the idea behind the micro displacement, right? By putting micro displacement and getting down to 10 nanometers, we basically put as much information into the physical model through displacement and therefore reduce the burden on the shading model, which is reproducing a BRDF that simulates roughness.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
And now hopefully people understand that. Most people will. All right.
If they're listening to you, I hope they I mean, we've said ICT a bunch of times, too. I don't know that anybody – have you discussed that before? Is that
– That ICT?
Uh-huh.
The Institute of Creative Technology? Yes. And don't worry, because I will – I usually do in a podcast at the intro. I do an intro and say,
oh, okay.
We are talking today to, you know, I'm not going to do it now.
And now you'll edit. Yeah, then you'll edit this part.
Yeah. So I do it in the intro, and no worries. People know right. The drill. They've heard this before. Go ahead.
So I just wanted to, because I think a lot of what we're talking about now, like the uncanny valley, has meant a lot of things over the last, 10 years, right?
Yeah.
Like starting with
robotics.
I would say, like, when it really. It was,
Final Fantasy?
Final Fantasy, thank you.
it's good.
Which you know, right?
And I've actually brought it up several times in this podcast. So, I mean, one of the things I think is awesome about Final Fantasy, it failed as a movie, but I think it was such an important movie in terms of our industry.
Forward. It was a huge leap forward.
Right.
It was.
A massive amount of work. And when I got out of school, my first job was... When I got out of grad school, my first job was at ESE, working on the Matrix sequels, and a lot of people had worked on Final Fantasy and had come over. You know, it was their next job.
Yeah.
Was starting.
I remember, on that show. So some of them were doing the Matrix rebooted, the animated series thing that they was there, right?
Right, which went a completely different direction.
No, I understand that, but those. Guys came from Square.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So we had a lot of guys there. But anyway, I think that, and even back then, everybody sort of agreed that, what the Uncanny Valley meant at that time was both the ability to create a photoreal still of a human being, as well as then see it, animated. Where I think that the assumption nowadays is everybody thinks pretty much we can nail a still image of a human, in CG, regardless of how you got there or whatever.
Yeah.
You can do a pretty convincing still image.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And whether you were just, basing it off of reference of a photograph you had of somebody you knew or not. And that where it falls down, now is primarily in animation.
A lot of people say that, and it's interesting because
so the gap, I think that's closing, and unfortunately that just when the fingers start pointing, it invariably sorts goes to the animators.
It does,
but and unfairly.
Who are the animators? Seem to blame the lighters all the time.
Yeah, but it's also not. It's not pure animation, right? I mean, it was
it all works
that
together.
Was captured data
Absolutely.
As well, and that's a subjective process, though. That's an animator taking some artistic license with a limited, data set or whatever. But I do think that when people think of that term nowadays, it has to do with a photoreal human in motion, and that's in motion is when it's.
The other Chris Nichols, there's another Chris Nichols at Digital Domain. We used to actually get each other's emails all the time. It was quite funny. But he and I still stay in touch with each other. And he sent me a link to Weta's work on, was it Weta who did Paul Walker on Furious 7? Yeah.
Am I allowed to say that?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, it was. You are allowed to say it. So there basically is a bunch of stills that came out on it. And it's like, okay, that's pretty darn good. I would say 99% of the people, if they didn't know, I'm talking about CG people, high-end CG, because I would say the thing that I've always think about the Uncanny Valley is everyone knows it's wrong, but no one knows that it is, right? When something's in the Uncanny Valley, everyone knows it's wrong. If some explosion is wrong in a movie, only the VFX people are going to know it's wrong, right? But if something's in the Uncanny Valley, my grandmother knows it's wrong, right? It's very hard for people to understand to not see it.
Yeah.
But when I saw those stills of Paul Walker, I'm like, I would say almost everyone, if they didn't know why they were looking at it, they would say that's just a person, right?
But you're looking at a still.
But I am looking at a still.
I haven't seen the movie.
Yeah.
I know that they used his brother as a, yeah, a stand-in.
As a stand-in. Right.
Stand-in, but they replaced the face on him.
Obviously. Yeah. So I saw the movie, and I'm pretty sure I can pick out the CG shots.
Now, would you say that's because of the... I hadn't seen the movie.
But, I'll tell you, it wasn't necessarily because of the rendering or anything like that. I think it was more because
it was moving on his face.
Because no. I think it was the body language of his brother or whoever the stand-in was just wasn't not Paul. Him. It was just not Paul. So I think that's probably the easiest way to tell.
Okay.
Yeah.
That or they constrained the shot in a way to make that kind of
So you know, even if the head tracking is perfect, I mean, that's not his body language. You know.
Right.
Yeah.
So you sense those things.
You sense
right?
those things, yeah.
And I think those are things that you feel that I think are important. I think that's something that was very cool about what Norman's saying is like you can sense emotion in a certain way that when it doesn't feel right, it feels wrong. And I think those are the things that he says are
immeasurable. I mean,
I don't know if they're immeasurable. Maybe, but those are things. Okay, well, sorry. Going to go back to another point.
Mm-hmm.
Speed. You talked about the idea of speed and the idea of...
Yes.
And an artist can go through iterations more quickly because he's making decisions that are not based on measured data or trying to get to a measured data, right? Yeah. So you're going click, 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 click. Now it's right. And it's just basically you just randomly fall upon it. It's like, QMC sampling. You basically splatter a bunch until it's about accurate.
Well, actually, you know, that's
an educated guess.
That's actually a very good metaphor.
Okay.
You know? Yeah. It's optimization. So,
You basically go out there and you're giving an educated guess as to where you want to go and you do a bunch of samples until you feel about right, right?
Yeah.
And so I feel that I don't disagree with that aspect, but that education is based on something that you know subconsciously. That's the thing that he's saying, that why do I feel the emotion of that person? I don't think that Leonardo measured the emotional factor of the Mona Lisa. I think that he sensed it and that it was his...
Or maybe it was something he was trying to convey, you know? He was maybe trying to communicate a certain emotion. When you look at the painting, he wanted you to feel a certain way, maybe?
Yeah.
I find the Mona Lisa to be uncanny.
Yeah, okay.
I'm not trying to be funny.
No, I know what you
know
mean.
What I mean?
But there is something about her smile that is very unusual, right? Now, I'm going to use the Mona Lisa as an example. I think there are other better examples out there. I completely agree with you. And I also don't think that necessarily, I mean, that was another thing that we came up with. And I talked to Angela Tinwell, and she argued the fact that getting unbelievably high detailed skin factors is not necessarily going to contribute to the uncanny valley either. She says, you know, look at, I'm looking at a video of you. We had a video Skype going on. It was like, I was blurry as hell, right? Because I looked real to her. Mm-hmm. That is not my lack of skin detail does not contribute to my uncanny valley. I think there's something that can be said about the roughness of your skin, et cetera. But 16K displacement map is not necessarily going to solve all your problems in terms of how your skin texture looks.
But if all I had to deliver to you was a shitty...
You can curse on this.
compressed for the web video using all CG, it's a hell of a lot easier.
Exactly.
Yeah, but like, there's that.
I'm fairly convinced that we could accomplish that, I think.
You think?
Oh, yeah.
I think there's something that's going on.
The problem is we're going to 4K now.
Well, I think I don't think that's the problem. I think there's something that happens overall that makes your emotions right. And I still think it's animation. I agree with you.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think this
goes back to, you know, what I said about the performance. I mean, you have to have somebody, you have to have a human being behind it, at least now. I'm not saying we're never going to get to the point where we can't synthesize, at least statistically synthesize a performance. What I mean by that is interpolate, not extrapolate.
Interpolate.
Yeah. So like if you have a set of, you know, if you have a large set of performances of someone, you could perhaps interpolate and basically synthesize a performance that like that is believable. But you would need that raw data to start with. I don't think you can, I don't believe that you can come up with a model of emotion which will all of a sudden animate in such a way that you will perceive it to be human.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think you would need to start with what actual performances to begin with.
Well, yes, and we've done that. You know, that was the whole idea behind art is reproducing reality, right?
Yes.
For a long, 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 long time, art was about reproducing reality. And once the camera came along and destroyed the need for that, right? So that's when, you know, more abstract art was starting to be created, right?
Yes.
So
exactly.
There's some reasoning behind that I think it's interesting. But what we've, obviously, what we're talking about is so this is the thing that I want to do, right? A lot of people ask me what the goal of the Wikihuman project is, et cetera. And part of me says, I don't necessarily have a goal. I just want to be able to create a data set that we can all look and study.
Just make it accessible, yeah.
Make it accessible to people. And I think it's a really cool idea. And every day I'm being approached by people who have some cool ideas. Today I got an email from some guy who basically wants to create his own system to generate microfacet detail synthetically without necessarily using scan data, so that he will base it based on the large scale displacement map and make his own.
Yeah.
It was really cool. And he basically sort of used his system on Digital Emily.
Yeah.
And basically looked at what he did, and he says, okay, now this is the 16K displacement map that comes out of ICT, and here's the one that I created, and this is the difference that I'm seeing between these two. It's kind of an interesting idea. But a lot of people are using this data to do stuff. That's the stuff I love. It's like it's advancing digital humans. It's allowing people to use a data set and try new ideas and try new things. But part of me also wants to I know it's a little bit of a highfalutin thing, but I believe that the more we can understand about digital humans, what makes them work, what doesn't make them work, and we can measure some of these things, because I think that's an important part of what we're doing, or trying ideas. You know, I still want to try your idea of skin flow and blood flow on a non-moving, non-animated face, right, to see if that idea brings something to life or not, you know. But anyway, the more we study that, I feel that the more we understand about digital humans, the more we understand about real humans. So I want to use the idea of the digital human as a proxy for understanding our own thing, right? Because I think the uncanny valley is, a lot of people are like, they want to get out of that valley as fast as possible. Like, they want to avoid it. I want to understand why the valley exists in the first place. I want to understand why we fear it, why it causes the emotional reaction, and what is it that gets us out of there is the interesting part to me. It's like, what are the actual things that cause that? So that's the idea of what I want to measure, in a sense. And I think that it's cool to think that as well. But that was kind of the thing that was revealing to me about Norman, is that, you know, he just said, just be human.
Yeah.
And his argument is, the more human he is to his subjects, the more human they are back to him.
Yes,
right?
Right. Definitely.
And that's part of how he directs the performances. But
he sits down with them for a long time as well.
3.5 hours, 4 hours, yeah.
Which probably helps.
And he talks to them. Yeah. It was very strange having a conversation with Norman. He sits down and he starts asking you more questions than you start asking him, so that he gets to sort of bury your, you know, disarm you completely, so that by the time he starts talking, you've become friends, and it becomes a different experience. And that's how he does, right? And it's really cool. And you know, after doing the interview with him, you feel like you actually went through a therapy session instead of actually doing that, which was kind of a great thing, you know? I mean, a lot of people don't, I don't know if people know this, but in like after the, I did the interview with him, it was over, mm-hmm. and he was, he continued to talk to me for mm-hmm. a while, and then he gave me a big hug, and he's like, this was a wonderful experience, and it was like, wow, that was really bonding and just very strange thing. He wasn't like, thanks a lot, you know? But I think, I also think he appreciated it because I wasn't sitting there going, so what was it like to be with Steve Jobs, you know?
Right.
Like, I wasn't doing that. I had an agenda in this specific thing, and I think that's what he liked about it, which was cool. But I think that there's something about that, and you mentioned you direct, right? You've directed a few shorts and you've done a few things.
I've attempted.
Okay.
Yes.
But you feel when you're directing that you have a drainage emotionally, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, what happens is, and, you know, this is not something I can explain scientifically or anything like that, but I think the process is that it's a transfer of energy. The energy comes from you, right? So you're transferring your energy to the actors and to the crew.
Uh-huh.
And it, you know, it's a zero-sum game.
Okay.
You know, so at the end of the day, you're completely drained emotionally and physically.
Okay.
You know, but, you know, I got good performances, so that's good.
Right.
So you have to get into that space, the space where you want them to go.
This sounds very much like Norman.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. And it does, and I think that's a really good thing. Now, artistically speaking,
right,
is that something that you can convey into a synthetic person? Because the advantage that you and Norman had at that point is you're dealing with a real person.
Yes, right? That's right. Yeah, exactly.
So can you transfer that energy to a synthetic person?
So I think that's what an animator does.
What an animator
that's
does.
That's exactly what an animator does.
Right.
You know, isn't it? So precisely, yeah.
But, okay.
That's adding the human factor where it didn't exist.
Exactly.
Though. You have to have a human do it. So I don't know.
An animator,
so the thing is,
or a puppeteer. I mean, you're bringing something to life, you know?
Right. Yeah. I think, and therefore that's the thing that I think that, you know, as much as we try to scientifically, one of the big goals, as an example, the first step in Emily 2.1 that we did mm-hmm. was to remove as many of the variables. So it's like, we measured this. You can start with this, but this is basically how the shader works, and this is the result you're going to get. And we feel that this is as close as possible mm-hmm. to what the real skin looks like. And we have an A to B, right?
Yeah.
So we know that this. But in order, you can't do that. You're basically saying, in order to make this work, you're just going to have a really good animator. You know? It's not going to be like, in order for this to work, you're going to have to do what?
Here's the thing, right? I mean, now we're stepping outside of photorealism because there's three things as far as I know. There is photorealism, then there is, cartoons.
Sure.
Right? And then there is what I would refer to as hyperrealism, which is creatures.
Yes.
Okay. So, you know, you're stepping outside of photorealism.
No. I understand. I know what you mean, but you're trying to make someone believe. Cartoons, you can convey an emotion in a cartoon. Hell, you know, Eric Cartman can have an emotion that looks real and he's just a sphere or a circle, right?
Right.
But that's fine. I believe that. But you want to believe that that person is human. That's the point of the Uncanny Valley is coming out of the valley in a lot of ways. There's arguments about it where it's no longer creepy is one of the goals. Mm-hmm. The other goal is that you don't know that it's not human, right? So is the you don't know it's not human, is that going to come from an animator? Or is that going to come from...
I mean, in photorealism, ultimately it's going to come from the performer, the actor. I think, as long as everybody else has done their job right.
You mean a capture system if we're going to do a synthetic human?
Well, what I mean is whoever's driving the performance is the part in your brain that's going to say that's a human being. as long as everybody else down the line, you know, from the capture system to the to the retargeting to the animator and rigger and lighter and
right.
And you know, match mover, as long as everybody else did their job, ultimately you're just going to say, okay, that person is human because that's, you know, the actor's coming through. Even though it might not even look, okay, here's the situation.
Okay.
You might have another actor driving
the performance.
Driving the performance.
Often.
Such was the case in Benjamin Button. You know, he didn't look
like Benjamin.
Like Brad Pitt. Like, you know, he didn't look yeah. like.
But a lot of that was done, I mean, obviously there's facial right? capture. A lot of facial capture, but there was a lot of animation to happen on top of facial capture.
There was, but ultimately, I think it's his performance that comes through.
Oh.
You know what I mean?
Yes, but the animator looked at the performance and translated that.
Well, you know, maybe embellished it. I mean, who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows?
I've seen a lot of raw captures come from A to B, and they're not always... They don't always come through perfectly, you know?
No, they don't. I'm not saying that retargeting systems are 100%.
Right.
But that doesn't mean they can't be. It just means that they aren't yet, mm-hmm. you know? So I think in the future, we're going to get very close to
right.
to fully automated retargeting. Maybe in a few years.
I'm fascinated by it. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of things to go through. We can kind of running out of time, but, you know, we could even get into the idea of, you know, what Mark Sager is doing, and he's creating a completely scientific human being, right? Digital, like completely artificial intelligent baby. And it's in the uncanny valley, but he's got
an interesting approach.
But it's a very, yeah. What's very interesting is how quickly she demonstrates the performance of this artificial intelligent baby. If anyone is interested in it, look up the Baby X Project, I think yeah. it's called, by Mark Sager. You are, the audience end up completely bonding to this
yeah.
very odd looking baby on this screen. Because it's an artificial intelligent baby and he manipulates it to showcase how it works,
mm-hmm.
You know, he'll show how the brain is actually functioning in this thing, and he'll
yeah.
remove the dopamine in the brain, and the baby starts looking a little weird because the dopamine is no longer being generated in the brain, and everyone freaks out.
Yeah.
They're like, oh my God, you just drugged this baby. It's like, it's not a real baby. But you feel the emotion. You feel like, how could you do that to that baby? You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So there is an emotional bond that happens.
There is. I think he's very successful, you know, with his system.
And I think the yeah. reason it works is because he's interacting with it, right?
Yeah. But also, I mean, that's a good point. I mean, he has a very successful system from that standpoint. Because he controls it at a higher level, or maybe I should say a lower level.
But let's go back to the Norman Seeff thing, because he's interacting with that baby the same way that Norman Seeff interacts with whatever's going on. So a lot of that emotion comes from his reaction.
Well, I mean, ultimately he's tweaking sliders, but I think the way he set up his model, the way he decided to set up his model, is different from the way a rigger would set it up.
Right.
You know, a rigger would want, you know, immediate feedback, whereas this is kind of, you know, controlling the brain chemistry, so that's not immediate feedback.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like, you know, almost chaotic feedback. In a way, there's feedback loops.
Right.
In the system itself, yeah. which is cool. So I think... he's got a very, very successful system from the point of view of bonding emotionally with it.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, I actually would love to get... Well, that's a long story. But, all right. We are running a little long.
Okay.
But I think we've had some really interesting discussions about those rules. And I don't think we're going to define it. I don't think there's anything we can say that, like, this is how we're going to approach the problem, because Right. I really appreciated the fact that a conversation with Norman sort of I've been so hyper-focused on, like, we're going to scientifically measure everything as much as possible to remove as many variables. And then it was kind of an awakening. It was like, there's only so far you can go with that. And I think that was one of the things that that sort of woke me up a little bit. And I think that when you brought it up as well, I was like, I want to hear your response to that. So,
well, I don't know. I think AI in general is interesting because I personally think that we're not going to get true AI with kind of, you know, good old-fashioned symbolic AI, symbolic models are not going to get us there. Are not going to get us consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, maybe the future of AI is brain simulation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, can you simulate a brain in a supercomputer? Perhaps then you will achieve consciousness. And I think it might happen soon enough. You know,
mm-hmm.
and at that point, you know, all bets are off.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, at that point, I'm moving to Antarctica.
Yeah.
Yeah, at that point, you know, the question of what is art, what is science, you know, what is creativity, all bets are off, you know.
Once we've actually defined consciousness.
Once you've created consciousness.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's obviously been a theme. In films for a while, you know, the whole 2001 to everything else.
Yeah.
It's a good way to possibly end it.
Yeah.
The extinction.
Once we've actually created the perfect digital human, we're all dead.
Sorry, guys. Yeah. Sorry, future people.
Yeah. So any closing remarks, Stephen?
No, I think I was going to say something when you were talking about Mark's work with the baby.
Yeah.
Because I have a...
You have a baby.
A very small child. in that, and when I was talking about the animation earlier, I actually should have clarified that too, is it's particularly facial animation and not just, you know, expressions. It's dialogue is where it breaks down. Like it, for a while, it was the physical animation, just the limbs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And motion capture largely solved that.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, you know, you're not looking at, you know, this is in the context of film, right? You're trying to make something good enough to project up on a screen and convince people that it was, you know, shot through a camera. You know, particularly with the body motion, and you're not looking at muscles, right? You're looking at a person who's clothed, wearing boots and other things that don't necessarily show you exactly what's happening underneath with the anatomy. And I think that that's perfectly suitable for the type of, the fidelity of that kind of motion capture. But when it comes to the face, there's a lot more subtlety that needs to be captured. And with the baby, as an example, baby's not talking, right? Like it's usually when it's through dialogue, right? You can get an idea of the humanity of it anyway. There was so the baby is a bunch of like involuntary muscle controls, like in their face. Like they just make these faces all the time. And you're just like, what are you doing? Like the smile is one of the first ones. And I mean, I have a theory that I don't think I've ever smiled the same way twice.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like in that, there's always something else going on in my face. It'll be slightly different than some other time or the direction I was looking or whatever.
Mm.
And like, I always feel like we do these capture sessions with actors and we run through these range of motion, range of motions, the fact stuff. And, you know, that's a really small data set, you know, that you have to interpolate from. And I think that's a... You know, it's a good place to start, and that's where your animators will come in and then finesse and build on top of that, which is that's the idea.
Right.
And Yeah, I just I feel like the baby's kind of easy. You know, for the same reason that we can, you know, we could.
Well,
let's not make a non-speaking digital human, like if you had a like Tupac, for example.
Right.
Like that was, you know, we didn't have any reference. It was, you know, honestly, it was, we didn't have a lot of time either, but, you know, that was set up so that we could get it done, right? Which meant you're not going to see a whole lot of, like, he was lip syncing.
He was lip syncing, and you also happened to have a microphone in front of his face.
But he had a big ass microphone in front of his face, and he moves around a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's being, you know, it's being projected in not, you know, the absolute best.
You look really good, though.
Quality, and it was convincing enough, right? So, like, for that venue, yeah, that was fine. And, you know, with the Baby X, which I haven't even seen, but it sounds fascinating.
I think the reason he started with the baby because of those, some of those challenges were not necessarily something that he had to deal with, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's why he started that. And he has actually done some projects.
The idea is that he grows that.
No. He actually has adults. He has adults as well that do talk and do stuff like that.
So, we're way over, but I was just going to, there's some interesting research in autism that have to do with, just how emotions are perceived and whether they're perceived at all. And, you know, if you ask somebody on a, you know, one end, like an extreme end of the autism, you know, spectrum to tell you whether Tupac was real or Benjamin Button was real, you know, what would their answer be?
There's actually some specific research that we're looking into as well with that, because Angela is actually specifically interested in some of those aspects as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we are part of the WikiHuman project, involves some of that exact research.
And vice versa. I mean, when you come across the, you know, anybody, child, adult, whatever, that is autistic, it doesn't take you long to pick up on it. You know,
right.
I mean, there's just, it's body language, and it's lots of things are missing. You know, lots of eye contact, lots of lack of emotion or whatever, and that's uncanny.
Yeah, and that was one of the things I always said. You know, I think there's a relationship between the uncanny valley and autism in a sense that one is, can an autistic person tell if something is uncanny or not? That's something that's interesting as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is. Is there a relationship? Does someone who is in contact with someone with autistic, do they have the same emotional reaction that they have when they see something in the uncanny valley, right? So is there a relationship between that? Is that why we feel a sense of discomfort? Because there is a sense of discomfort when you sense uncanny valley, and there's a sense of discomfort when you're talking to someone who has Asperger's or autism, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not necessarily conveying the correct emotion or whatever is supposed to happen in there. So I think it's fascinating to me. All right. Yes, you're right. You are going over. But I really appreciate it. I think this is a fascinating conversation. I think it'll be a great follow-up to Norman's podcast because it'll Norman's obviously was very non-technical because, you know, he doesn't know anything about CG. And I think we can sort of ground into sort of, you know, the aftermath of that podcast. This is a perfect one to sort of to do that. So I really appreciate it. You're moving to Seattle in like a few weeks.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, that's going to be awesome. So you're going to stay in touch, please.
Yes.
Let us know what's going on.
Yes.
Love to hear more about what's happening over there, and let us know if we can help you out in labs. I know you're not necessarily going to talk about what we're doing, but have some idea, and then let us know if we can do some cool stuff with you guys there.
I'm sure.
All right. Thank you, Stephen, too, for coming by and staying a little late to do this.
You're welcome.
All right. We're going to let the last bucket drop, guys. All right. Take care. Bye.